Next, I'm going to introduce Lili Shi, who is professor at Kingsborough Community College and also an ARI board member who will be introducing our keynote speaker.
I met Betty for the first time, I think, in the summer of 2016 when she was on the panel. We had the Building Asian American Studies Fellowship Summer Institute at CUNY. That was probably one of the most transformative experiences that I've ever had at CUNY. I think I found my my intellectual and professorial identity in that space. So ever since, I used her work for my class, and I was just telling her that, you know, she has some fangirls, like including myself. We do like a cultural space, a photo essay, and I always use her work as like an entry point, how, you know, the geopolitics of Chinatown can be expressed through all those artistic projects of hers. So yeah, on behalf of the RE board member, the planning committee of this symposium, I have the incredible honor to introduce Betty Yu as our keynote for the symposium. Betty Yu is an award-winning socially engaged multimedia artist, photographer, filmmaker, educator, and activist born and raised in New York City to Chinese immigrant parents. Betty integrates documentary film, installation, new media platforms, and community-infused approaches into her practice. Her films have been screened and featured at the Directors Guild of America, Sydney International Transgender Film Festival, Mesa Film Festival, and Visual Communications Los Angeles Asian Pacific Film and Video Festival. She holds a BFA from NYU and an MFA in Integrated Media Arts from Hunter. Betty is an adjunct assistant professor teaching new media, film theory, art and video production at various colleges in New York City, including the New School, John Jay College of Criminal Justice of CUNY, Pratt Institute, Marymount Manhattan College, and Hunter College. In 2015, she co-founded Chinatown Art Brigade, a cultural collective using art to advance anti-gentrification organizing. Betty's documentary, Resilience, about her garment worker mother fighting sweatshop conditions, screened at the national and international film festivals, including the Margaret Mead Film and Video Festival. Her multimedia installation, The Garment Worker, was featured at the Tribeca Film Institute's Interactive Showcase. In 2020, she worked with housing activists to create Resistance in Progress, a multimedia installation featured at the Queens Museum. Betty recently had her first solo exhibition, Displaced in Sunset Park, at the Open Source Gallery in September 2018. This work is also included in the 2019 BRIC Biennial. Betty has received numerous grants for her work, including supports from the Art Matters Foundation, Asian Women Giving Circle, Brooklyn Arts Council, Wave Farm Media Arts, and the Paul Robertson Fund of the Independent Media. She is a board member of Third World Newsreel and Working Films, and on the advisory board of More Art. So let's welcome Betty Yu.
Thank you so much, Ari, for the invitation, and Diana and the board and everybody here. I am a graduate of CUNY, and I also teach in the Hunter Integrated Media Arts MFA program as well, so it's really kind of full circle. It's nice to be here. But I wanted to first acknowledge that we are on the indigenous ancestral unceded lands of Lenne, Hoking, the Lenape people, now known as New York City. We must pay respect to the Lenape people's past, present, and future, and their continuing presence and struggles in their homeland. It is a real great honor to be invited to speak to you today during these unprecedented times, as we are witnessing a catastrophic genocide being inflicted on the Palestinian people in Gaza, nationwide repression of pro-Palestinian student activism across campuses, and locally, increased poverty, housing displacement, building of new jails in the four boroughs in New York City, declining wages, mistreatment and scapegoating of new migrants, and so much more injustice, right, that I could probably be here until midnight naming them all, as we know. And of course, our planet, you know, is melting, you know, as we speak. But we see billions of tax dollars going to fund this genocide. I mean, it's very important to talk about it, right? As we are in the midst of this movement of divest and defunding this genocide and war. And we know that this money can go toward lifting people out of poverty here in the U.S. and toward proactive measures that can build a liberatory future for all of us here, right, in what we call the United States. So this year's symposium theme is interrogating AAPI identities. And I open with these remarks because for me, and I believe we really are at a crossroads at this critical moment in human history that we seriously have to look deep within ourselves as people of good conscience and ask ourselves, which side are we on? So much experience is here in this room, obviously, right? There's like professors, there's students, folks from the community at large. And so it's nothing new that I'm saying, but I do think that making those connections and thinking about expanding our definition of who is an Asian American, what is Asian American identity, and looking at our history, the history of Asian American activism, and particularly in social justice movements throughout the history of Asian Americans in the United States is really important at this moment, and to think about Palestine, to think about what's happening there. And the American empire here funding that over there, right? So as I said, you know, for me, it's really inseparable to talk about what's happening. My identity as an Asian American is inseparable from my identity as a daughter of Chinese immigrant garment workers, as an artist, as an educator, and as a social justice activist. We know our history. We know that our communities have faced tremendous adversities and challenges throughout the history of this settler project, our colony, right now called the United States. As we know from the 1882 Exclusion Act, Chinese Exclusion Act, to the 1942 Japanese internment camps, to so many other anti-Asian sort of moments that show up in policy, show up in nativist, literally burning of Chinatowns down, and to the recent spike in anti-Asian hate and violence during the COVID pandemic. And so we have been perpetually othered, we know this, scapegoated, and demonized as a yellow peril by white nativists, by white supremacists. And in the 60s, we also know that we were labeled the model minority, right? All of a sudden, we were the good immigrant, the docile and passive minority that was purposely created and weaponized to pit us against people of color and other immigrants of color during the civil rights and the black liberation movements, right? There is a shared history, a long history of black and Asian solidarity that I'm sure here, people who are like me, you know, avid students of history, we know this, right? As we look at, you know, the history of black, brown, and Asian communities, and even, and of course, indigenous communities, always deemed the undesirable, right? We work side by side, building railroads, right? Because we are the lowest on the totem pole. We're also living side by side because of redlining housing policies, right? Of the 30s, 40s, 50s, and outlawed in the 60s, but some would argue that that still exists today, unofficially, living side by side, right? Often black, brown, Asian communities, undesirables forced to live side by side, right? During redlining. And so I say all that to say that, you know, we can't be fooled. The perception of the crazy, you know, rich Asians is really just sort of a mirage, right? I mean, we know this, right? I mean, I want to point it out because, again, it's being weaponized, right? And falsely depicting us as the white ascending, aspiring, upwardly mobile. We're there, right? We are the rich, crazy, rich Asians, right? Asian Americans who only care about getting our kids into elite schools like Harvard and here locally at Stuyvesant, which we all know has been a very, 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 very divisive issue that reached the Supreme Court and got rid of affirmative action, which is terrible in the education system. That is one small minority of Asian Americans. This narrative is false. It's falsely pushed by corporate mainstream media and the power structure, right, to further this model minority myth and further divide us, right? This doesn't represent us. We know this, right? Our actual lived objective reality. And in fact, There were studies, right, in the last couple of years that show that income inequality in the U.S. is rising most rapidly among Asian Americans, surpassing, I should say, Asians in America, surpassing African Americans as the most economically divided group in the U.S. So I'm here to talk about my own identity, again, as an activist, educator, but mostly, as I'm going to turn to the slides, as a multimedia artist, a storyteller, filmmaker. You know, and before I kind of talk about my work, I am, I do want to say that, you know, talking about our Asian American identities here today, throughout the day, this is something you, for those of us who are folks of color, right, that's a hat we constantly wear, our own identity. But I think identity politics are really limited without context, without class analysis and understanding its relationship to power and how the larger power structure of capitalism really uses our identities to further the American settler project of colonialism, imperialism, and capitalism, right? So we know that probably these terms of which I'm on, you know, cultural art washing, pink washing, green washing, all these things, are identities that are often weaponized, right? And for instance, I'll talk about Chinatown and how art washing and these new galleries and how art has been used really to displace folks in Chinatown who are long-term, who've been in Chinatown for many, many, many years, but how all of the sort of the exotification of Asian American identity in Chinatown has been weaponized, right, to displace the people so that they want the food and the culture but not the people that actually make Chinatown Chinatown. There are contradictions. I mean, I'm going to talk about gentrification and displacement and my own identity as a working class Asian American and roots here in the U.S., you know, but also we are on stolen land, you know, and there are movements for land back. And, you know, how do we, I'm not saying I have the answers, no one has the answers, right? How do we support indigenous people and their sort of, their right to sort of, to through their land, right, that they've been pushed out on, and like, I don't know, how many hundreds of treaties that have been broken at this point. But also, how do we assert the right for people to have a roof over their head, to be able, the right to stay, which is very radical. The right to just stay in your home and not have to move 5 times within 10 years is very radical right now for anyone. I think maybe people in this room can attest to that. Anyway, and so I think that, you know, we can live in these contradictions, right? I'm also going to talk a little bit about the communities that I've been working with using art and culture, particularly those that have been facing mass displacement and gentrification. And so I'm going to actually open very quickly. I think it's worth noting and sharing my own background someone who is, I always say that I'm first, but I'm fourth generation, and I'll explain in a second. So I found out very recently that I had a great-grandfather who was in the United States who migrated to Nevada. And it's unclear what he did. You know, we like to say he worked in the railroads, but there's stories that maybe he did work in the railroads, but he was running a gambling parlor or den, which I'm not, you know, I mean, I'm not mad at that. I think all these things should be decriminalized. But anyway, or, you know, destigmatized, rather. But, you know, so I will say that. So I found that out very recently, and I knew I had a grandfather who. So my great grandfather couldn't build roots here, as we know, the anti-Asian sentiment and hysteria. You know, the labor unions at that time that were the forces pushing the anti-Asian sentiment, hysteria, and passing the 1882 Exclusion Act. Right? It was mainly white nativist working class folks. Anyway, the Chinatowns were burned down. Right? All throughout the West Coast. And so people like my great-grandpa, you know, couldn't build roots really in the U.S. So it was a lot of back and forth. My grandfather, who came, managed to stay, but then had to go. There was a lot of back and forth. And during the Exclusion Act, he was an organizer with the Chinese Hand Laundry Alliance here in New York, which was a radical left organization. At one point, they had as many as 5,000. Hand laundry workers in the organization, but during McCarthyism, they were targeted during the Red Scare, and many of them sadly left the organization. But anyway, so I found out, I knew that part, but I didn't know about the great-grandfather, and I'm still trying to figure out the paperwork and all that to find him, and, you know, he obviously came through the West Coast and all of this. All that to say that I have different iterations in my family, and so it's weird for my identity now talking about being first generation versus, okay, now I have like a few generations back of folks who were here, lived here for some time and then had to go back. My mother and my father were both garment workers, working in Chinatown first, and then after 9/11, a lot of the factories moved out, as we probably know, with gentrification and displacement. And mother got sick from the repetitive stress that she was facing, and it got worse. And so she was working part-time in the factories in Brooklyn and Sunset Park. So I'm from Sunset Park, Brooklyn, born and raised. Just to say that that's sort of my like background as someone who was born and raised in Sunset Park. And I wanted to share sort of a very pivotal moment for me. It took me about 6 years to make this short film that you know has shown at different festivals. This is like many, many, many moons ago. But it documents my mother and my sister's activism. So my mother, who was a leader in garment organizing, who was a garment worker herself, risked blacklisting, risked a lot to come forward and organize. So she worked with the organization called Chinese Staffel Workers Association. She organized with them intensely for many, many years, talking about her repetitive stress injuries, her syndrome from working as a sewing, as a seamstress. And my sister, who at the time when she was a college student in the mid-90s, went on a hunger strike with four other students in front of Jing Feng Restaurant. And Jing Feng Restaurant, at that time, it's a much smaller version of it now, but at that time, it was one of the largest restaurants in the East Coast. And her, as a college student, hunger strike with four other students to expose what was happening in Chinatown, like third world within. You know, the Department of Labor is right there, like literally a couple blocks away, but you have workers who literally were making 75 cents an hour, and their tips were being stolen. So you have workers coming forward, and my sister was really someone who was really my my beacon of light, who really inspired me. She was in college, I was in high school at the time, and since then I've been involved in organizing. But I'm going to share just a very short clip of this, but I can also share the longer, you know, kind of with anyone, the longer version. It's like distributed by Thermal Newsreel now as an educational video.
Childhood memories with the sound of my mother's sewing machine as she worked through the night. Only to find herself in a garment factory the very next morning. Since my family immigrated to America, they've been working in sweatshops. I grew up in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, one of the largest Chinese immigrant communities in New York City. Traditionally, during the Chinese New Year celebration, dragons come to greet business owners to wish them good luck. Here in Sunset Park, sweatshop owners are greeted as well.
我遲啲呢，因為我今日出嚟睇咁高興，我今日出嚟睇呢度冇衣，咁啊晏啲呢，我同波士講咗，老闆講咗，我晏啲會返。我哋衣廠呢，就係近唐人新年呢，就係旺季，好多衣，好多嗰啲訂單，嗰啲contract，咁啊要趕出衣去啦，第二個stick，即係第二個週，咁所以我哋呢，通常呢，就每一年呢，就係中國新年都係啲旺季，即係好多衣做嘅。 咁所以老闆有時候想賺多啲錢啊嘛，監啲工人要趕衣咯。喺香港揾食都係唔係咁即係好，即係好唔係咁好咯？即係一餐揾餐食，一餐揾餐食。既然而家係咁話，點解我哋唔走嚟美國？ 碰下個機會咧，我喺1972年嚟美國咯，咁就嚟到美國咧，初初咯就好艱難咯，咁加上我即係我有兩個女好細個咯，咁加上我又抬住個 BB。
The crib and
or just playing with the toys on the floor. But then after I got older, actually my mom went back into the factories, and then my grandmother, who was working in the factories at the time, came out and started to take care of me.
你个 grandma 几睇住咯，咁我唔可以出嚟衣厂做咯。
记唔记得我哋细嗰时咧，你成日带我哋行，即系接我哋翻学放学咧，记唔记得？记得。如果我哋讲咧，有一次咧，嗰啲有啲男仔咧，成日从我哋咧掉咗啲糖落我哋嗰度咧，记唔记得啊？做咩我你咧就闹佢哋咧？记唔记得？
我都唔记得啊，
好耐啦，
好耐你细。
好耐啦，边零
咧？咁样我哋就揾个。
你鬧佢哋啊？
你
梗係鬧佢。
你鬧咩
㗎？我鬧咯，我啲阿仙
嚟㗎。Grandma was definitely a big part of our lives. I think before Grandma used to work in the factories for a while. Our mom had to stay home, pretty much work at home, take care of me. I remember Sheila and Karen going to school while I was at home with mom. And so things started to change once I got older, I went to school, grandma stopped working, started taking care of us, all four of us, and mom would go out to work.
做咗廿幾年醫廠咧，我覺得咧，真係我哋真係要大家工人要團結啦。我哋以前一個禮拜做$200啦，廿幾年前一個禮拜又係$200，而家二十幾年後一個禮拜又係$200，但係佢嘅價錢咧，同以前咧我哋裝條拉鏈咧，以前毫半紙，而家又係毫六紙，有時毫八紙，但係嗰陣時嘅毫八，而家個毫八紙就係而家使。
有啊，醫廠環境啊，真係好差好差，嗰啲紙啊，成地都係，又冇人嚟執住。嗰啲衫啊，飛到全部嗰啲塵咧。
啊，我哋工人咧，就尤其是我哋衣廠工人咧，真係受波士氣壓啊，同埋好緊要，成日都係做過時工，有時做到好夜都未放工。有啲波士咧，就嗌啲工人咧，就加班，加到11點都冇天糧，冇晚餐俾我哋食。
嗯。
真係㗎，
冇晚餐
啊！一路做到11點半，仲未啲醫啦，然後先去買飯俾我哋食。
因為我咧，自從1995年加入咗職工會咧，我感覺職工會咧係我哋工人嘅大家庭，同埋係我哋工人爭取權益嘅一個好嘅領袖。
I don't want people to say, oh, well, back in 95, so-and-so did this and so-and-so did that. And I really feel like that's not the only thing I've done, and that's not the only thing I want to be known for, you know.
Meanwhile, here in the city, Chinese students protested in Chinatown against what they term human rights abuses in New York. The protesters claim Chinese immigrants who escaped China to New York are forced to work long hours, earning as little as 75 cents an hour in Chinatown restaurants.
We're not slaves, we're not second-class citizens. We want the same human rights everyone else has.
Because
I don't
need
help.
Because
I
don't need help. It's okay, it's okay.
I'm a daughter, so I saw those workers, and those students, so well for themselves and for workers,咁大犧牲出嚟絕食7日話，如果唔係我個口講話絕食就絕食話，真係唔食嘢個7日嘅話，即係要約好大嘅好 strong 嘅人，即係好大好個人好 strong 先可以得喎，係咪？即係好大個好有個毅力先可以得嘅喎。
when I was younger, when I was doing the hunger strike, I felt that, oh, just one way was enough, just getting the message out, hunger striking. I think that was a pivotal point in actually changing the dynamics of the case, because now we had broken through, but through to the outside world, kind of beyond Chinatown.
They came to be seen and heard. More than 200 demonstrators led by Chinese American students marched through the narrow streets of Chinatown. They were there to mark the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre in Beijing, China. It was 6 years ago today that hundreds of students were killed in the democracy movement that was crushed by government troops.
The students in 1989 fought oppression. And what we're doing here, we're saying students are going to fight the oppression in Chinatown.
They are demanding enforcement of labor laws and government intervention.
For 18 years, I've watched my parents. Ever since they came to America, they've had to come to this slave labor, being treated like second-class citizens. And after watching them, I know I have to fight for my own people.
I think that before the hunger strike...
So then Trin, who goes on to talk about another hunger striker, how the cops basically... There was going to be a huge rainstorm, and the construction workers, who are members of this organization... built a structure to hold a tarp up, and the cops just like took it down. And you know, there's a proven collusion between the cops at that time, the restaurant, the owners of a lot of different businesses. So she goes on to talk about that, and I filmed the cops actually breaking down the structure and taking it apart, and then taking away, and as a result, the hunger strikers literally had to like hold the tarp like over them during the hunger for that night. So I'm gonna actually just go to the next slide real quick and talk about some of the other work. While I was involved with Chinese Staff and Workers Association, I was also actively involved I've studied film in college at NYU, but decided that for me it wasn't what I wanted to do at the time, so I did full-time organizing, labor organizing for a while, but also continuing to document people's stories. And often you hear the story of the passive, sort of docile Asian immigrant, right? The model minority who doesn't speak up, but I was seeing the complete opposite. So it was, for me, very important to document these stories. I also was working with a lot of young people, young immigrants. At the time, this is in the 90s, right, way before all these platforms, democratization of the video sort of making tools, which definitely made it accessible for us to make these videos. And we received a grant from a local public access station. So we trained each other. I trained young people and older folks, and they were able to document their stories of their labor conditions. And this is fast forward many years later. A lot of these stories integrated into my work. So this is called the garment worker, and it's actually a machine that you can operate. So it's an interactive piece. And as you operate it, you hear different stories of different workers who are fighting their employers, like DKNY or Kathy Lee Gifford. This is, you know, way back in the early 2000s. And then I have check stubs for my mom, and you can see that even in the unionized shops that she was working in, she was basically making less than minimum wage. And so to kind of show kind of these conditions through some empirical data, I guess, but also in a creative, artistic way. And then some of this is like archives from my grandfather's photos. So I found, when my grandmother died, I found about 5 photo albums, which is how I discovered my grandfather was a co-founder of the Chinese Hand Laundry Alliance. My parents never really wanted to talk about him, and because he died when I was very young. He was a communist, basically, right? So they didn't really want to get too much into it, and so I had to problem solve myself and, like, be the Sherlock Holmes, I guess, and, like, investigate, or the Nancy Drew, or whatever the reference is. But anyway, so this is a mixture of photos of my grandmother, my grandpa. My grandmother eventually was able to come in the 40s, you know, when my grandfather was... enrolled in the military during World War II to fight the Japanese. He never actually served, but as a result, he was able to bring his wife, my grandmother, here. So they operated a small laundry, laundromat, hand laundry business. And if you can see some of the members, I found this one photo, which is apparently one of the only photos that exist of Chinese Hand Laundry Alliance members. They're wearing shirts that have like a red star with CHLA. I believe it's red, it's black and white, I don't know. But now, this is now in the Museum of City of New York in their permanent collection, because they haven't been able to locate a lot of these images. And then this is more, another iteration in a show in Chinatown more recently. Again, this time you can pick up the phone and you can actually listen to stories. I made a short film trying to figure out my grandfather's sort of connection to CHLA and FBI. I found FBI documents that were still redacted from the time during McCarthyism when they were like highly surveilled, and I found a person who sadly passed away of COVID 2 years ago, but who knew my grandfather. And I literally walked in there, interviewed him, I showed him the picture. He was like, oh my God, that's my mentor. Like, I know him. He was a lot older than me, but I know him. That's okay. So there was a whole moment there that was captured, but sort of full circle moment. But anyway, so these photographs are, I've used it in my work through mixed media collaging and just through the photographs themselves is showing that. Because I think that for us, at least for me, I'll speak for myself as a Chinese American, Asian American, the photographs that I've seen, the images that I've seen perpetuate certain stereotypes, right? And as we know, with the power of photography and an image and lens-based, right, like art, that is very manipulated, right? And so oftentimes you're not sure if the person who's sitting actually have agency over how they're being presented. And so for me, I was fascinated with the everyday photos. I mean, literally, my grandfather was an amateur photographer and took so many photographs, talking from the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, because he went to Chicago first in the 20s, or he would clearly be in front of the camera, behind the camera. So the everyday life that's captured is really rare, because for him, as a person who had no money, not a lot of money, to buy a camera and film and to document, to have that kind of thought of like, I want to have this preserved, I don't know, is like, as an artist, is kind of mind-boggling for me personally. So, and I only found these photos in the last 12 years, I guess. And then these are some of the mixed media collages that I've created that have been shown at different places. There's a book that I'm working on that's coming out in the fall that is a mix, basically, of mixed media collages and of the photographs from my grandfather's collection. And then I wanted to just share some other sort of multimedia work. And so this is Displaced in Sunset Park, where basically I've been documenting people's stories in Sunset Park in the Latinx and the Chinatown part of Sunset Park, interviewing folks and talking to them about the changes in the neighborhood, the good and the bad, their hopes, their dreams for the neighborhood. But the fact is that not only people know about the Sunset Park side, right, the actual park of Industry City, but not really that aware of what's happening in the Chinatown Park. My parents live right there in the middle of a lot of the development that's happening. And so through my personal story, but also my personal story is a portal into learning about how other folks, like small business owners, are struggling and lost their spaces of business, all kinds of laundromats that have closed down due to these other businesses. And after COVID, honestly, a lot of the small mom and pop places have closed because they couldn't get the big loans. And then you have these like chains, like these like the Taiwanese or the Hong Kong or the Korean kind of, well, French bakeries that are Korean owned, that are the chains, right, that have come in and replaced the mom and pop places. Like, if people say, oh, well, they're Asian, like in Flushing, same thing, or in Chinatown, in Sunset Park. Yeah, they're Asian, but they are not. They're big corporations, right? Yeah, they're not the mom and pop places that I went to growing up between all the three Chinatowns, So anyway, so as a part of the show, you could use a phone and bring to life these stories using augmented reality on your phone. And then I did sort of artist talks as an activist and artist talks as a part of the work. Some of this on display where I wanted to use technology in a way innovative way where people could take walks and then put their phone up to different locations and a story will emerge, a placekeeping story, I call it. So it could be a small business or it could be a hair salon or it could be someone's home, a construction site of a new building, and you learn about that story. This is where people kind of bring those stories to life. And Tari Hum, who some of you might know, who teaches at Queens College, and she's awesome. she's from Sunset Park, right? So she talks about that, and obviously her book and her, a lot of her, the focus of her study is really on gentrification and international sort of international finance that is funding a lot of this gentrification. And then a personal lens is important for me through like sort of making, kind of helping people understand why I care about the issue. So we have these funny photos back since I was a kid we would take in front of our house, and I realized that my grandmother was sending it back home to China and Hong Kong to show this kind of like, oh, look, we somehow are established and made it. You know, it seemed silly to me at the time, but then I grew to understand why she was doing that. And then archives. So part of the show was also people, as they were telling me their stories, I was also collecting archival photos from them, not the original, but, you know, copies. And also counter cartography and looking at maps and how neighborhoods have changed, as we know, not because they just out of the blue change, but it's these developers who push city government to change the names of neighborhoods. So this show was actually in Sunset Park, but people kept calling it South Slope, right? If you know anything about neighborhoods, and I know we're all very neighborhood proud here in New York City, especially here in Queens and all over. But I was showing maps from back from like way back, 150 years ago. It's like 17th Street is Sunset Park. And I said, no, it was rezoned by developers mainly because Sunset Park was undesirable at that time. And South Slope was the desirable place because everyone was being pushed out of Park Slope. So, you know, so kind of using literally where this gallery, community gallery space was at, like a little moment, a teaching moment, was very interesting. But anyway, so the maps kind of show the changing of neighborhoods in Brooklyn, names of neighborhoods. And then one person who, I don't know if you can see here, but this guy here, he moved to Sunset Park with his wife in the 1970s. They're Puerto Rican, and to start the Puerto Rican Socialist Party chapter there. And he was like, oh, there's this photo of him with Jane Fonda, who you can't see to the left, but you know, Angela Davis. All, he's like, yeah, I don't know if you want this photo. I'm like, yeah, I want this photo. So it's in the film. And so he's this like leader, you know. Apparently, he spoke at, you know, at some point they filled the Madison Square Garden with 20,000 people, and he was one of the leaders of that movement at the time, the 70s, and it was like this gem. But anyway, so this is an ongoing project. Yeah, this is the paper. This is the broadsheet that I would give folks to do the walk, and so I would lead walks as well. If you just keep going, and this is the other flip side of it: instructions on how to use the app, or you can just walk and look and read the story as well. And then as a part of the times that I've shown this work, I'll lead placekeeping walks where we stop, and this is the end of the tour. We're industry cities behind us, and we went through Chinatown already in Brooklyn and all that. So that's a big part of, for me, to embody what the changes are and what they look like. So a little bit more how showing people how to use the app. Go to the next one. This is in Queens Museum, like 2020 to 2021, or 20, I can't remember now. COVID is like a big mush, as people probably feel the same way. But at the time, the Queens Museum had a show about home and what home means. And they asked me to contribute something to the show, and I, of course, being very, my work is very place-based, I wanted to make new work that showed what was happening in Flushing, Queens. And I worked with Min Kwan and the folks there to basically highlight that we're working with coalitions that I'm sure folks here are familiar with. I don't want to get into it, but many, many organizations fighting it right now. The casino that they want to build, right? The coalitions are a part of fighting that. So at that time, really highlighting what was happening. And in particular, the folks who were the leaders of this work, and also this collage right before COVID shutdown, I had like 5 or 6 magazines, real estate magazines, that were all mainly Flushing based, like Flushing properties. And you can map out like the median price of an apartment was like well over $1.1 million, which, you know, I think it's like Flushing is one of the fastest growing in terms of construction and real estate prices, like I've heard like hundreds of percent, maybe even 1,000%. But anyway, this kind of shows that, and then the handwritten stuff, pictures I took and then made copies of people sort of like, you know, roommate ads, right? Like asking for roommates. And you could see that, like, trajectory of that going up. Like one bedroom is like 1,300 and two bedroom. Anyway, so the idea is to kind of show kind of this, you know, kind of the increase of rents and the displacement. So it has a whole timeline, and then I made a short film that was in Korean, Chinese, Spanish, and English that sort of showcased the organizing that was happening at that time against the waterfront development. Yeah, so that's just a little bit more of the collage. So this is a current project I'm working on, interviewing folks, especially during the rise of anti-Asian hate and violence. But also the nuance of it, which is that, yes, we've been here for generations and generations. There are new immigrants. But also the solution is not necessarily that we want more policing in our communities to further pit us against black and brown folks, right? And so there's that nuance. So through interviews and through public events, an event that I did with the Asian American Arts Alliance, where I collected stories from people, video, and also people's stories, handwritten stories. I projected these in Flushing. Actually, I forget now, because this is the building that people were like, we have to project onto that, because everyone hates it. It's like a newer development. And so collecting stories, and then it became a screening in Flushing on the wall in the Chinatown in Flushing. And again, people talked about, we keep us safe, right? We don't, you know, police doesn't automatically mean, you know, cops don't automatically make us feel safe, right? In fact, we know the history of police brutality. And of course, this is during the uprising, right? So I wanted to really show that nuance. And then I want to just end on Chinatown Art Brigade. So I co-founded Chinatown Art Brigade with Tamir Rai and Mansi Kong in 2015. And from the beginning, we worked very, very, very closely with CAB, Organizing Asian Communities, their Chinatown Tenants Union. And they have been organizing almost for 40 years on sort of pan-Asian organizing on many different issues. And they started off actually fighting police brutality of people of color and Asians included. That's how they started in the 80s. But then the last 20 years, because of gentrification and displacement in Chinatown, as we know, after 9/11, when people like my mom couldn't go to work because the trucks couldn't go in, there's no ingress, egress for garments, right? Garment trucks. But anyway, that all, so everything we see now in Chinatown, that was already in the works, like in, you know, 2002, 3, 4, that kind of gentrification, all the policies and the zoning. And so CAB has been organizing in Chinatown for over 15 years, and particularly protecting tenant rights, organizing tenant unions, rent strikes, and this kind of thing. So this is on the rooftop with CAB, Chinatown Tenants Union, and Chinatown Art Brigade members on the rooftop of a tenant, actually, with the glasses on the right. She was facing literally gates. The landlord gave her 30 days for her and her and folks to vacate, right? And so they wanted to turn this tenement building into sort of market value real estate. So it was a lot. You know, this is one of the many. Organizing efforts happening, right? And then as a part of our work, Chinatown Art Brigade, we really believe in the power of art and culture and media to really change hearts and minds and really to show, not just tell, but really show what is happening and how people are fighting back. And so in this slide, I can see we did a series of workshops, 8 weeks long workshops with tenants and residents and members of the community, and basically this is Mrs. Zhang, who is a leader at Chinatown Tenants Leader. And there's a block that she never walks by because there was a garment factory that she worked in, and she knows it's like a luxury kind of tower now. I mean, a luxury kind of condo kind of thing. And when she went by, she saw that it was like a fat condo upstairs, and also a luxury gym on the ground floor. And she stopped and talked about that for a while. She worked as a seamstress for 20 years in that building. And so as we did these walks, so different tenants and different residents would lead walks, and along the way people could photograph, sketch, write, map, or write chalk on the floor. And so people kind of did whatever was moving them. And then this walk on the top right is Mimi, who That is the rooftop that we were on. This is the her home. We're in front of her home, where it's like, you know, probably six rooms. That was one apartment at one time. There's Mimi again, and then there's Liz Moy, who is a fourth generation Chinese American, talking about the Jim Crow fight and that history. Her grandparents, grandparents started Great Noodle Town. She started mapping out the galleries early on, about almost 10 years ago, that were replacing mom and pop places in Chinatown. And at that time it was 110, and now it's about 120, 130. Even with COVID, things bounced back. That replaced, you know, so literally you used to pay $10,000 for rent, right, a bakery, and then all of a sudden it's $25,000, right, because these spaces have become like Trojan horses that raise the real estate level, the real estate values, right? And so that there's no going back, right? To the $10,000 of rent, all right? How many funds and, you know, coffee would you have to really sell, right? A commercial gallery, sells four pieces of work in a month and they're set, right? So that's the sort of trajectory. And then up here is the community mapping that we did with members of the Chinatown Tenants Union, mapping out places that are still there, are no longer there. So the projections, so we took people's stories and artwork and images and slogans that people wanted to project, and then these were in the form of a number of projections that we did in the evening. And it was the tenants that said, the only way we're going to reach folks who are not active is literally bringing the work into the public. Reaching them when they're coming out of the subway, buying groceries. You catch them, that's how you catch them. So this worked really well. There was a song that tenants rewrote, of a famous Chinese song, into a tenants song. And random people came and started singing with them. That was a moment, an organizing moment, where people could talk to other tenants in Mandarin or Cantonese or Fujian, you know, whatever. There were organizers there, stopping, you know, there just to talk to people who stopped. And to watch. Then we just turned into a mapping project where the sort of 2.0 mapping project where similar, we're using augmented reality to bring these stories to life. So this is what we're currently working on. We've had different iterations of it, and you can see in the bottom, in the middle, what was, if folks know, the Music Palace, which was the last movie theater in Chinatown, showing Hong Kong movies, you know, movies from China. Is now the hotel, the Wyndham Hotel. And it had a very, very well-known mural on it called the Respect to Working People. Respect of Working People. Anyway, that name, that combination of names. But anyway, Tamia Arai, who's the co-founder of Chinatown Art Brigade, worked with young people in 1977 to put that up. And that was a landmark for everyone in the community. Like, you want to meet up? Like, when I was a kid, let's meet up right in front of the mural. So that's been gone for the last 15 years. And then Wing on Woe, which is a legacy, the oldest business in Chinatown that's still around. So places of resistance and places of resilience that are still there fighting the good fight. And then we've been also creating tenant rights videos where tenants themselves, again, this is their idea. We want to be able to tell others our experience and how do you navigate housing court and all this stuff, right? Advocate for yourself, even if you have your lawyer with you. So these videos were looping at the cab office. When you walked in during the legal clinic, they would wait for clinic, right, for housing clinic, and you could watch this. Like, literally, people speaking it in your own sort of language, literally, but also in terms of, like, this is what you expect. This is how you navigate. Because it can be very, very daunting. And then this is the final one, I think, which is just talking a little bit about our work around abolition. So folks probably know there's a new jail that, of the four jails, you know, the plan from 2016 was that Rikers would close and that these four new jails would replace them in the city, minus Staten Island. So Queens, Brooklyn, Manhattan, Bronx, thank you, Bronx. And the one in Manhattan is being billed as the tallest in the world. So they're calling it a jail scraper. And in fact, they are really, really touting that as the feature. It's going to be a 40-story tallest jail in the world. So folks have been organizing, you know, strange bedfellows. You have the NIMBY people who are like, no, we don't want it because, honestly, some, you know, some under sort of subtleties of, maybe not so subtle, of anti-black racism, right, in the Asian community. And some who are like, no, the property, our property value is going to decrease. But then you have folks who are coming and emerging with an abolition perspective, saying like, no one deserves to be in a cage. And even if you paint it as like the most, you know, these are supposed to be social justice jails, right? Social justice driven kind of minded jails where you have UV lights and you have some places where you can just, you know, be bathed in UV rays to simulate like you're kind of outdoors, right? You know, all these things, right? A lot of social justice groups, and you probably know this, nonprofits who are behind these borough-based jails. But we believe, many of us believe that there's no such thing as a human cage. No such thing as a humane cage. And so we've been doing these events in Chinatown, the jail. If you walk by on White Street, where the old jail is, where the old detention center is, they're demolishing that and building a huge, like, sort of monstrosity of a jail. Folks have been organizing and fighting it. They did break ground and is going up. Chinatown Art Brigade has also been calling out the Department of Cultural Affairs, which is a city agency, doing a call out for work, for artwork, for the jail. So folks probably know 1% of any project like this has to go to art. So this is a $16 billion project, $16 billion to build this jail to put people in cages. And then 1% is 60 million out of 16 billion. So $60 million will go toward art and culture in this jail. So they're putting out the call for artwork in this jail. There's so many other things I can think of that $60 million can go toward, and it's not a jail, and the art and culture could go very far in other ways throughout the city, as we know. You know, so that's something that we have a letter writing campaign, if you're interested anyway, denouncing the Department of Cultural Affairs and calling out for artwork for the jails, for all the four jails. And then, yes, the here fuck cages, which is truly what we believe. And we were also connecting it to art washing, so the Museum of Chinese in America in 2017-2018 agreed to a $35 million payment in return for their silence silence in opposing the jail. And so that was to help them buy their museum. This was done very hush-hush, and we were one of the first groups to really expose that and started organizing to expose that. And now there's ongoing protests I'm going to kind of wrap up here, but ongoing protests that are happening. It's happening there now. If you're interested, you can look up like Youth Against Displacement on Instagram. You can find out the ongoing fight because MoCA on many levels is not an institution that represents us anymore. It started out as a radical art institution by Chinese Americans, and it's absolutely not that anymore.
You know, as you move through today, through these panels and workshops, you know, and you consider the theme of interrogating AAPI identities, I really encourage you to think about your multiple identities and your hats that you wear, hats that you wear. And folks here are very seasoned folks, like a lot of very familiar faces, but just kind of leaning into the hat, the social justice change maker hat, right? Because solidarity can show up in so many different ways, right, as we know. And we are at a big turning point, and there is no going back. You know, change is really upon us. These are both incredibly exciting and terrifying times, and I know it can feel really heavy for all of us, but we have to really, now more than ever, really consider our social responsibility as students, as professors, as teachers, as people, human beings, also here in this higher education institution, to respond to this moment, just like millions did in 2020, right, during the uprisings, during the Black Lives Matter movement, and calling for structural change. We see a similar moment now where change is inevitable and is erupting around us, right? And students are really leading the way, young people are leading the way. And so I just want to heed that call and just remind ourselves that identity can look very different. Solidarity looks very different. And what does that mean for us to show up as allies and activists, as change makers in this space? And that as a fundamental part of our Asian American identity, and that always has been.
So I'll just stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Betty, for sharing your story and experiences. I think I'm not alone in saying that was tremendously inspiring, right? And it's a reminder that our work is never finished. And there's so many ways in which we can engage with work for the community, the broader community, however we want to define that.